benim ikinci konuşmacım A.J. Roberts. Bayan Roberts, Tulsa Üniversitesi'nden kimya ve Pensilvanya Üniversitesi'nden de molekül biyolojiyi, hücre biyolojisi alanında doktora derecesi bulunuyor. Roberts, 97-2001 yılları arasında Yale Üniversitesi'nde viral patojenler ve aşılama üzerine çalışmalar yürüttü. 2006-2013 yılları arasında Virginia Üniversitesi'nde mikrobiyoloji fakültesinde yardımcı profesör olarak çalıştı ve mikrobiyoloji, immünoloji ve bulaşıcı hastalıklar programının başkanlığını yaptı. 2013-2015 yılları arasında Yale Rivendell Enstitüsü'nde misafir araştırmacı olarak faaliyetlerine devam etti. Dr. Roberts, hakemli çeşitli bilimsel dergilerde 40'tan fazla makale yayınladı ve dünyanın dört bir yanında birçok ulusal ve uluslararası bilimsel konferansa katıldı. 2005 yılında bulaşıcı hastalıklar konusunda araştırmaları dolayısıyla liyakat ödülüne layık görüldü. Şu an bilim ve dinin uyumu biyokimyasal seviyede yaratılışın delilleri gibi konularda çalışmalar yürütüyor. Dr. Roberts bugünkü konuşmasında evrimcilerin sıklıkla başvurdukları kelime oyunlarına dikkat çekecek. Evrimin sözde kanıtı olarak öne sürülen bazı süreçlerin aslında evrimle, yani bir türün başka bir türe dönüşmesiyle mutasyonla hiçbir ilgisi olmadığını açıklayacak. Ayrıca evrimcilerin mikro evrim gibi isimlerle bu süreçteki sanki evrim gözlemlenen bir gerçekmiş gibi insanlara empoze etmeye çalıştıklarına da yer verecek. Okay, the floor is yours. Thank you very much. And your time is only 30 minutes.
Thank you.
I too would like to thank the Organization of Techniques and Science Research for inviting us to Turkey. I have thoroughly enjoyed my visit in Turkey, and it is obvious to me that Turkey's greatest resource is her people. And so we pray often for your peace and for your welfare, especially in light of recent events. So perhaps you have heard this statement. I was once asked if I believe this statement is true. There is more evidence for evolution than that the Earth revolves around the sun. Well, it might be true. It depends upon what you mean by the word evolution. And that's what the rest of my talk is about. Evolution is a word that is often equivocated. Equivocation is a process that depends on a word having more than one meaning. It involves using a word in a context where the meaning is glossed over in order to make a faulty assertion and to make it more defensible. In equivocating, you're assuming one meaning, but actually using the word in a different context. This is often what happens with the word evolution. Someone makes a statement like this. Is it true? Well, it can be, but it may also be false. It is critical by what you mean by evolution. The word evolution, we are going to spend the next few minutes unequivocating this word, trying to bring some clarity to whether or not that statement might be true. The word is used in different contexts, actually in reference to five different categories of different types of naturalistic processes that are dependent on different underlying mechanisms to work. These are the five categories that we will be looking at: chemical evolution, microevolution, microbial evolution, speciation, and macroevolution. My colleague Fazel Rana just spoke to you in some detail within 30 minutes about chemical evolution. So I will not spend too much time on this topic, and I will only highlight a couple of hurdles that chemical evolution faces. But chemical evolution, as he said, refers to the process of generating life from non-life. It is sometimes called abiogenesis, and it is synthesizing biogenic molecules from inorganic compounds. And these are the building blocks for cells. It is at the basis of the naturalistic explanation for the origin of life. But the hurdles it faces are many. One of them are the chemistries required for the synthesis of many of the biogenic molecules. These chemistries are not compatible with one another, so if you're trying to generate a sugar, you will have a different chemistry than if you're trying to generate a fatty acid or a nucleic acid, which is at the heart of DNA and RNA. But not only are the chemistries not compatible with one another, The chemistries are not compatible with early Earth conditions. A second hurdle, which I will spend a little more time on, is the homochirality of the sugars in RNA and DNA, and also the homochirality of amino acids that are found in proteins. Chirality refers to the orientation of a molecule, and it's sometimes referred to as the handedness of a molecule. If you think about your left hand and your right hand, you can see that they are mirror opposites of one another. Although they both have a palm and thumbs and four fingers, you cannot superimpose one upon the other because they are mirror opposites. This is the problem of chirality. It is true that the sugars in DNA and RNA and the amino acids in all proteins share only one orientation, either a right-handedness for sugars or a left-handedness for amino acids. But if you try to generate sugars or amino acids through naturalistic processes in the laboratory, you don't get a single type of left-handed molecule for amino acids or a single type of right-handed molecule for sugars. You get a mixture that's called a racemic mixture. And the ratio is about 50% left-handed and 50% right-handed sugars, 50% left-handed, 50% right-handed amino acids. This makes it very difficult to synthesize RNA or DNA because of steric inhibition and chain termination. Yet biological processes, those that occur inside the cell, in stark contrast, produce only left-handed amino acids and only right-handed sugars for RNA and DNA synthesis. This is a challenge for naturalistic explanations of the origin of life, and I think it points to a mind behind the molecules that we find in cellular processes. So all life, in summary, has only right-handed sugars and only left-handed amino acids, and yet there is no known naturally occurring mechanism for generating or selecting or stably maintaining a solution of only one or other molecule. The third hurdle is a naturalistic account for the origin of life is one of information, which again my colleague Fazal Rana has spoken to you at length in his 30 minutes. The DNA, as he described, is the molecular blueprint for all genes and all gene regulation, and by RNA intermediates for all proteins that are produced inside the cell. The information that is stored in the DNA molecule is one that is often appealed to as indicating an intelligent designer, and many argue that it requires an intelligent designer or God to produce this type of information. But it is not the information that is most difficult to explain within the cell. There is also information at the system level, which Dr. Rana also referred to. How did the cells orient different proteins in different cellular subsystems that accomplish different molecular processes? Where does the information come for structuring these things in the right orientation and also for making them work in concert together that in a way that is highly complex, intricate, and almost orchestrated like a symphony? It's not enough to just account for the information in DNA, but it is necessary to account for this higher level subsystem metabolic process information as well. Maybe it would help if I gave you an analogy. So if you think about trying to build a car from the ground up, you need all of the parts of the car, and each one, whether it's the plastic parts or the rubber parts or the metal parts or the gasoline, requires information on how to produce those parts. But it also requires mechanisms to produce those parts, not just the information. Okay, so now you need information for the mechanisms, you need information for the production of the part, but that's still not enough. You're left now with just parts of a car. You still need information on how the car systems interact in order to generate locomotion, in order to generate combustion. And so you have to have system-level information in order to put the parts together in the right way in order to get an automobile that you can drive. But even this, I think, is a poor analogy if we're trying to express the complexity within a human cell, within a living cell. A better analogy would be if someone was able to account for all of the functional interactions, all of the pieces, all of the mechanisms that are involved in something as complex as the city of Istanbul. The fourth hurdle, which I will not spend any time on since I have four more topics to talk about, is that life on Earth occurred very early. And the life that occurred on Earth occurred almost as soon as life could be sustained on Earth. And it occurred in a highly complex and diversified manner. This challenges, as Fuzz addressed it in his talk, and as I have mentioned so far in my talk, leads many scientists who are committed to a naturalistic paradigm to appeal to something called panspermia. Panspermia is a hypothesis that the biogenic molecules, or perhaps even life itself, did not originate on Earth, but it originated somewhere else in the universe. And that it was transmitted to Earth either through natural things like comets or meteorites, or perhaps through an advanced species. But panspermia does not actually account for the naturalistic origin of life. It just displaces the problem to some unknown place in the universe where the biochemical and physical and chemical laws would be the same, and where the challenges of producing life from non-life have not changed. They've just been moved to a different location. So panspermia is not a solution to the problem of the origin of life. And in conclusion, we must reach this, that chemical evolution is not a logical conclusion based on scientific evidence for the origin of life on Earth. It is only a naturalistic appeal to account for what we see. So the second category is microevolution. And microevolution is the process of accruing unguided changes or mutations in the DNA sequence. The mechanism and characteristics of microevolution are twofold. They are unguided or random, and they occur through natural selection. These two elements, unguided and natural selection, are the hallmarks of Darwinian or neo-Darwinian evolution. The mutations themselves occur due to different types of stress that are encountered by the organism, such as UV radiation, hormone responses to stress or heat, and as a result, the DNA can become damaged. It can break. But repair mechanisms exist within the cell that can repair and rejoin the double-stranded DNA ends. Mutations can then occur either through the damage done to the DNA or through the repair mechanism itself. Unguided mutations in the nucleic acid sequence can also occur when the DNA is replicated by the polymerase protein. As it copies the nucleic acid sequence, sometimes it makes mistakes, and it has the ability to actually correct mistakes, but it is not 100% accurate in correcting mistakes. So it still makes a mistake in about 1 in every 10 million base pairs. So mutations can occur as a result of damage or broken DNA, repair of DNA, or replication of DNA. The main point is that mutations create variability. And when there is variability, selection can occur through natural processes. This means when a mutation occurs that allows an organism to survive and thrive in a given environment, then that organism will survive and thrive. If, on the other hand, it is a deleterious mutation, then the organism will not survive nor thrive. It should be apparent, and Dr. Rana also pointed this out, that natural selection is non-teleological. It's his blind watchmaker reference. It's not goal-oriented. It's not being driven towards a specific goal or a specific purpose. It is simply natural selection done through the blind process that cannot foresee which mutations might one day provide the ability to thrive in a different environment or in a more complex organism. This is a very important element in the neo-Darwinian and Darwinian theory, that evolution, including microevolution, is non-teleological. I find this to be one of the biggest and most confusing problems that people face when they talk about evolution and specifically about cellular and molecular biological processes. It actually leads them to endow the organism with a teleology of the organism's own design. The organism becomes self-directing towards some explicit goal, present or future. And others endow molecules or segments of DNA with an intention to survive and propagate. Perhaps you've heard of selfish genes. At heart, this is an imaginative storytelling effect to captivate an audience. At worst, it is utterly nonsensical and ridiculous. Either way, it is not scientific. In fact, it's counterintuitive to what we know is true about scientific mechanisms and processes. But cells and organisms are so richly endowed with complexity and adaptive capacities and variations that it's hard to describe such layers of complexity without resulting to language like this, which is often wrongly employed. So the third category of evolution is microbial evolution. Microbial evolution refers to the process of cellular organisms such as bacteria, archaea, simple eukaryotes, or yeast, as they rapidly reproduce and adapt to changing environments by selection of beneficial microevolutionary mutations and promiscuous gene swapping. So bacteria and other simple cell organisms can actually gain genetic information through three different mechanisms. The first is one called conjugation. Conjugation occurs when bacteria come in contact with one another and one bacteria transmits genetic information to a different bacteria. The second type of horizontal gene transfer or exchange of genetic information is transduction. Transduction is vector mediated. Viruses that infect bacteria can carry genetic information into the bacteria, and if it's a temperate virus, it remains in the bacteria without killing the bacteria, and the bacteria can replicate having gained new genetic information from the virus. A third mechanism that bacteria or single-cell organisms can use to exchange genetic information is one called transduction, or sometimes transformation. And this occurs when a bacteria dies or it is lysed, it releases its genetic information into the environment. At such a time, it's possible for other bacteria to come in contact with the genetic information and take it up into itself, acquiring new genetic information from the bacteria that had just lysed. So whether it's through horizontal gene transfer or microevolutionary mutations, transfer of genetic material, again, is unguided and non-teleological, and it could be deleterious or beneficial or neutral. But it should be obvious that when the genetic information is taken up into a bacteria, that it can quickly spread throughout the population of subsequent progeny, because it's a single-cell organism. So all the mutations that occur in a single cell are then reproduced in all of the progeny that result from that cell. So this mechanism is a very powerful mechanism that allows bacteria and single-cell organisms to survive and thrive in changing environments. Mutations in unicellular organisms allow adaptation to changing environments and optimization to specific ecological niches on an ongoing basis. This brings us now to our fourth category, which is speciation. And much like the word evolution, which we're in the process of trying to unequivocate, species is another word that is often equivocated, used in many different terms and meanings under different conditions. This actually has a name. It's called the species problem. And the species problem results from a wide range of approaches in defining how species are identified and in how species function in nature. And each approach for trying to identify how species function and how they're identified within themselves is known as a species concept. And currently, there are at least 26 different recognized species concepts. That's phenomenal. But the important point is that you must be very careful to know what the other person is talking about when they are going to use the word species, especially in the context of this topic of speciation. So speciation refers to the process in which a given species becomes genetically, phenotypically, or by appearance, and behaviorally distinct species. And it's typically due to geographical isolation that results in reproductively independent groups. During speciation, radiation events occur when a single starting species is split into various ecological niches, where they encounter variable environmental pressures. In relative isolation, organisms undergo different types of environmental stresses and pressures that affect the organism at a microevolutionary level and also at a genetic drift level, because now we're talking about multicellular organisms that sexually reproduce. These variable stresses and environmental pressures can also result in epigenetic changes that can affect a species' phenotype and behavior. And over time, each niche will mold and support a species that will be specific to that ecological niche. So Darwin actually described a speciation event in the observation of the different types of finches on the Galapagos Islands. He identified 16 different types of finch that were primarily one of the hallmarks of the different species was the size and width and thickness of the beak of the finch. But recent studies have indicated that beak morphology, or the shape of the beak, changes in an oscillating fashion, not in a progressive fashion towards some new and novel structure. So in wet environments, the beaks will be thin and narrow. In dry environments, the beaks will tend to be thicker and more wide. So this suggests, at least on one level, speciation results from a type of phenotypic plasticity that is adaptive to varying environmental changes. In other words, it's not unidirectional change or progression to something utterly new. It's an oscillating change. And it's also not allowing an organism to make giant leaps from one taxonomical level to another. All of Darwin's finches remained finches. It's also true for evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould's research in snails, also on an island environment where the snails were isolated into different geographical regions. But again, what Stephen Jay Gould described was biodiversity within snails that were well suited to particular ecological niches, but they were all snails. It was an adaptive diversification within snails. More recently, red and eastern wolves, which are geographically, phenotypically, and behaviorally distinct canids, have been examined at a genomic level. These canids are actually protected as endangered species in the United States and in Canada. But at the genomic level, what they've discovered is that these different species are really just genetic hybrids of coyotes and gray wolves. This new data is actually threatening their protected classification and status as endangered species, and it highlights the species problem in regard to evolution. Much like selective breeding in dogs, wolves, coyotes, and dogs seem to be the result of variation over time within an ongoing species radiation event. No doubt populations are now isolated, certainly by behavior and geographic constraints, but the various species may not actually be isolated in the sense that they can no longer crossbreed. So recent research also shows a connection of species within an ecological web. In this study, they looked at plants and flies and wasps, and what they basically showed is that the species co-adapt to changing environments, and it's driven by environmental change. But yet, even these examples, contrary to what the papers claim, has no significance to macroevolution, the changing of a particular species into a different kind or a different taxonomical classification. And even if we, like the North American wolf study showed, choose to call the species something entirely different, like wolves, coyotes, or dogs, it doesn't mean that one kind, a canid, is giving rise to something other than a canid. Finches remain finches, snails remain snails, plants, flies, and wasps, although they're changing and co-adapting together, remain plants, flies, and wasps. Finally, if we consider the speciation in the context of humanity and what we believe as Christians, that there was a primordial human pair, Adam and Eve, that were created in God's image according to the Torah. In his image, he created them male and female. If you believe the scientific data that dates mitochondrial Eve and Y chromosomal Adam to 150,000 years ago, then all of the diversity that we see in the human population today results from an ongoing speciation event in humanity. Consider the differences of the major races and ethnicities. Compare some of the island groups of Australia to Asia or the Middle East or European or Native American people. Or consider a dwarf and compare it to an extremely tall human being. Nevertheless, no matter our diversities, we are all human. We are all Homo sapiens sapiens. The last category is that of macroevolution. And be very careful here, because this is where equivocation takes place most often. Macroevolution refers to a series of naturalistic processes occurring over long stretches of time that account for all of life's history, form, and complexity, resulting from descent with modification under pressures of natural selection acting upon unguided changes in population genetics in a contingent and non-teleological fashion. It is supposed that macroevolution involves multiple different mechanisms for achieving its end goals. One mechanism is that of genome duplication. But genome duplication is simply replicating a genome that you already have. You now have twice as much of that genome. And it provides no new information, just greater amounts of DNA. In current observation, genome duplication in human cells is most frequently associated with cancer. And so this type of genetic increase in information is actually deleterious. Similarly, with translocation or jumping genes, where some segments of DNA can be transferred and copied into new positions in the chromosome or different positions in the genome, this type of mechanism can shuffle DNA information within a genome and replicate some portions of the DNA. It's not providing new DNA, and in current observations, this too is associated with human disease. Horizontal gene transfer, although it occurs by viral-mediated mechanisms, it is not the same as that occurs in single-cellular organisms. For horizontal gene transfer to even take hold in a human population, it absolutely must occur in the germline, in the egg of the female or the sperm of the male. Two other mechanisms, co-option or symbiogenesis, are often appealed to as well to account for some of the diversity. But each of these has its own hurdle. Generation of new organisms by these mechanisms is not evidenced today. It is rather an appeal to a sketchy, if not well-imagined, extrapolation of observed complex interdependence of symbiotic organisms to account for large-scale naturalistic changes in life's history. Although many mechanisms are appealed to for macroevolution, no plausible account has yet rationally and reasonably described the muddy middle layer of mechanism. No credible mechanism or explanation has been offered for generating true novelty. No account can be given for the rapid record appearance of most known phyla and fossils that occurred 540 million years ago in the Cambrian explosion. No true transitional species has ever been identified in the fossil record or through phylogenetic analyses. And no genetic map exists showing a clear Darwinian pathway from one order, kingdom, phyla, class, or order, to another. So what do we do with the evidence? I believe the evidence concludes that we must reject chemical evolution and macroevolution as not being well evidenced in the scientific data. But I believe also, from the way that I have defined and described these other categories, that microevolution, microbial evolution, and speciation are all evidenced. Each of us knowingly or unknowingly interprets the data in a way that fits into our view of reality. Molecular adaptation, I think, is a better phrase, or perhaps even molecular variation, to take the place of the word evolution in our opening statement. I think it is better to rephrase it that there is more evidence for molecular-based adaptation or variation of highly complex and wildly diverse organisms than there is that the Earth revolves around the sun. But I think that this view supports the view of progressive creationism, that God created life over long epochs of time, according to specific kinds. And God endowed his creatures with the ability to adapt to challenging and changing environments for their continued survival. So progressive creationism is a reasonable and rational conclusion concordant with the data, accounting for the diversity and early appearance of complex life. And it also accounts for the fine-tuning intelligibility of the universe, which my colleague Dr. Zwierink will talk about this afternoon. As a first century apostle of Jesus put it, "For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, so they have no excuse for not knowing God." Or as the psalmist David puts it, "The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. Day after day they continue to speak. Night after night they make him known. They speak without a sound or a word. Their voice is never heard. Yet their message has gone out through all the earth, and their words to all the world." Former atheist and philosopher Anthony Flew actually converted to theism before his death, even though he was a major proponent of atheism prior to this. And he puts it this way near the end of his life: "We have all the evidence we need in our immediate experience, and only a deliberate refusal to look is responsible for atheism of any kind." Francis Crick says that biologists must constantly keep in mind what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, was a naturalist, and the only basis for his comment is an undying dedication to a naturalistic paradigm, not a clear and open-minded examination of the evidence. So, in conclusion, I would say that a Christian paradigm or a theistic paradigm is far better for science than a Darwinian naturalistic paradigm, because according to the Christian paradigm and theistic paradigm, natural laws allow reproducible regularities that we can examine. We must observe the world in order to know what it is like, as my colleague said in her introduction. Nature is a reliable revelation of God. The scriptures actually tell us that God reveals himself in nature and that he has created us for inquiry and discovery. He wants to be known. The scriptures also tell us that truth can be sought and obtained in the words of Jesus: "When we seek with all of our hearts, we will find the truth." In conclusion, God wants to be known, and he has revealed himself clearly to those who have an open mind and a humble heart in nature and in scripture, and in the person of Jesus Christ. So those who seek will find that there is a creator of all that we see. Thanks be to God.